afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, January 20th. We have one item on our agenda today. That is an overview of Xcel Energy's Integrated Resource Plan. So thanks for being here, and we'll, Mr. Evans, the floor is yours. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. And I'm here to field the easy questions, and I brought a guest to field the hard ones, and he'll actually be making most of the presentation, but I will sit down here at the table nevertheless. So our fellow we brought today is Kurt Hager. He is our Managing Director of Resource Planning. He heads the team that is responsible for putting together our 15-year resource plans from time to time, and he will describe that process and the most recent plan that we filed with the PUC.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Kurt Hager, Xcel Energy. Thank you for letting me come and go over our resource plan. I think it's definitely a change from where we've been, I think where the industry's been, and we'll talk a little bit about that. The 2015 Upper Midwest Resource Plan is basically the company's vision of what resources we need to add to the system through 2030. We typically do resource plans every 3 to 4 years in Minnesota, and they have a 15-year look going forward. So 2015 plan goes through 2030. We'll be filing another resource plan probably in about 3 more years, which will start to look at the next issues that will start to develop in 2030 to 2035. And when you see what's coming, you'll see that those are very important issues, because a large portion of our baseload facilities start to get to the end of life at that point in time. When we looked at our resource planning process this time, we really attempted to develop a balanced mix, making sure that we keep cost in mind for customers, ultimately what kind of carbon reduction we were trying to achieve, and in this case 40% carbon reduction, but also to move the utility forward into that time frame so that when we start making those decisions for 2030 and beyond, we're well positioned and we don't have risk of any one fuel too great on our portfolio. And you'll see that when we go through this, that it was one of the major drivers is to de-risk the portfolio as we go to 2030, because we will face challenges as we go past there. So if you flip the page to the next slide, resource planning is really done in kind of two worlds. One's a capacity world. That's the iron in the ground. That's the resources that we need on peak day to make sure we serve the hottest days, the most critical days of the year. And that's what you see here as a slide. Now, because we know that wind doesn't always blow and sun doesn't always shine, so when we look at renewables, we have to have thermal resources to make sure that they're available so we cover that peak day, that capacity need. And you can see from the resource plan here, this is a look at our capacity. You see the nuclear assets on the bottom and coal. The yellow, which disappears in the middle, is our Manitoba Hydro contract. That expires in 2025, and so that's why you see it going away there, is that we don't show any kind of contract renewals unless we actually have signed those renewals. So it doesn't mean that we won't re-up with Manitoba, but for our resource plan, it becomes one of the planning issues that is solved for as opposed to a given. But then you see up in the upper right-hand corner, the new solar, the new wind, and the new natural gas, you know, about 2,500 megawatts on our a little bit over 10,000 megawatt system is what we're trying to solve for on a capacity basis. And you can see most of that comes from new natural gas combustion turbines. A little bit of it comes from wind and a little bit from solar, but for the most part, it's that combustion turbine, that gas asset, that's going to provide that reliability function. Now, if you flip the page, the other side of the world we deal with is the energy side of the equation, right? So you got the capacity, that's the peak day, that's the reliability issue. The energy is more the economics. It drives emissions, it drives more of the economic cost of the energy, and that's where the wind and the solar, the renewables, start to become more of an important factor. And again, one of the things that we were driving for is balance. We didn't want too much exposure to natural gas because we actually feel that we'll probably get a lot of natural gas after 2030. And so when you look at the energy mix, 2015, you can see coal about 37%, natural gas about 8%, The carbon-free resources in the light blue on top, about 55% total. Nuclear's 30, wind's 15. You look to our preferred plan in 2030, and we're not that much different. Again, maintaining that balance. So when you look at it, nuclear's 28%, about the same. Wind goes up a little bit from 15 to 25. Solar starts to show up at about 8%. Coal reduces from 37% down to 29%. Natural gas stays about the same. And so when you're looking at the kind of the combination of the capacity, the iron in the ground, and the energy, and trying to balance those, I think what's important for us is we didn't want to have too much natural gas exposure because of the volatility that we've seen. Now, with the new gas discoveries, volatility has been down on natural gas. We'll see if that stays. And if it does, our plan is flexible enough to take that into account and to migrate a little bit. And so I think what we're showing here is we've taken some of the carbon risk out of the portfolio, whether if you agree, whether there's a cost of carbon or not, or how you treat carbon. The fact is that when we have a lower amount of carbon, we have less risk associated with that. We have low risk associated with our natural gas purchases, and our portfolio remains balanced. The next page. Is the age of our fleet. And as I talked to just a minute ago, when you look going forward, you look at the major components, Sherco 1, 2, and 3, the three coal units at Sherbourne County, the King plant, Monticello, and the two units at Prairie Island. And then you look over on the right-hand side and you see around that 2030 to 2035 time frame, almost all of those plants are at their end of life. And so that's why we have some major decisions to make of exactly what do we do in this resource plan, how do we set up this resource plan for the next two that are to come. I did highlight a little bit more on the Sherco 1 and 2. Currently, those two units had a book life of 2023. In this plan, we've proposed to extend the book life of those to 2030. Again, to get as much out of those resources as we can before they start to approach their end of life. And so that's a key component. Now, we have proposed reduced operations at Sherco throughout the year, but the fact is that we're proposed to keep those units so that they're available for reliability. Again, something that we want to make sure that this plan sets us up for success going into the next two plans, which will be critical for Minnesota. If you look at generation additions, the next slide. Again, what we're proposing in here and how you look at this chart is these are the assets or resources that would be added in five-year blocks, and you have to add them cumulative from left to right to get to the total. What we're proposing over the next 15 years is to add about 1,800 megawatts of additional wind generation, about 1,700 megawatts of additional large solar generation, 500 megawatts of distributed solar, and about 1,750 megawatts of combustion turbines. So when you look at that overall, again, a fairly diverse mix, not too much wind, not too much solar, not too much gas, again, to keep that balance, but to allow us to get to resources that have fixed costs. One thing that we get with renewable resources is a known fixed price for the 20 or 25-year period. I can't get that on natural gas. I go out, if I'm lucky, I could get a 10-year contract. Usually, the producers would only want to go 5 years. And so that means I'm exposed to volatility with natural gas that I'm not exposed to when I look at some of the renewables. But again, you can see over the time, these are the resources that we would expect to propose to add. Next page. And the final slide, again, shows what our carbon reduction would be by 2030. When we look at 2005 as a measuring stick, our plan would bring us to about a 40% carbon reduction from that 2005 level by 2030. And we do believe that we can do this within a rate impact of no more than 2% on average per year over this period and still achieve this type of carbon reduction. Again, in my mind, what we're talking about here is de-risking the portfolio. Because we can always debate what carbon may cost or if there is a cost. But the fact is, that if I have less in my portfolio, I have less volatility and less risk. And so I think that's what we're trying to do, is balance so we don't have cost, we don't have exposure to too much natural gas, we don't have too much exposure to carbon. And again, we're kind of driving down the middle of the fairway, I view, in the fact that we're trying to stay well balanced, because we really don't know exactly what's going to happen. I mean, if you look back in history, what we thought was going to happen in 2008 when gas was trading at $8 a decatherm certainly hasn't come true today. And so our plan is to maintain balance, because we know we're going to get some twists and turns going in the future. And the fact is that we think we can migrate the plan as we see those twists and turns coming, but that we're well balanced so that we're not any one direction too far. And with that, I will open it up for questions.
Mr. Evans, did you wish to add anything to that before we go to questions?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you. A couple of questions for me, first of all. With regards to the assumptions for 20, is there any assumption of breakthroughs in energy storage or how much of this will be stored on the grid?
Chairman, no. We tend to stay pretty close to the vest with things that we know. Energy storage is something that we really don't have included in the plan in any significant way. So major breakthroughs in technology, we would expect that as we go through our 3 or 4 year update cycles on the resource plan, that we would add those in as we come along. But frankly, I think what our plan has would allow those resources to be integrated if and when they become commercial and cost effective.
And in terms of assumptions of, is there any assumptions built into this in terms of upgrading of the transmission grid to get renewable energy sources to match with load? Are there assumptions built into that?
Mr. Chairman, we actually, in our resource plan, when we come up with the cost of the renewable resources, we add a transmission adder to those costs so that we identify what we think would be an approximate average cost to add renewables. So that's included in our cost estimates.
In terms of the new generation, do you have an estimate of how much, and I know you guys get really down in the weeds and this stuff, but an estimate of how much of this new generation would actually be in Minnesota versus in other jurisdictions that may have higher capacity factors?
You know, that's a good question, Mr. Chairman. We've always typically gone to where the resource is the lowest cost. And I think in the wind, the developers have figured out where they can get wind cost effective. And we have, you know, right now Minnesota is about 75% of the system load. And we got 25% between Wisconsin and the Dakotas. And so we've looked across all of the states for those resources. I think solar is still kind of being figured out a little bit as far as where the best place to put solar, where land costs versus radiation and some of those type of things. Right now, typical process would be that we would put out an RFP or a proposal, and it would be broader than just Minnesota because the system serves broader than just Minnesota.
Sure. So first of all, Representative Isaacson moves approval of the minutes dated Wednesday, January 14th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails on a 1-0 vote. The first question, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Pollution Control Agency just put out a new report on air quality in Minnesota, and I'm guessing you all have read it. Probably more thoroughly than I have. What they said is the health cost from air pollution are $30 billion a year. I was astonished. How much of that cost is attributable to you guys?
Mr. Evans or to Mr. Hager?
How much of that cost is attributable to us? You know, I don't know the answer to that question. It would depend on which emissions were causing the problems compared to automobiles and agriculture and industry. I will take a look and see if I can find data on that and provide it to you.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, that would be helpful, Mr. Chair. It would be kind of helpful for us. I mean, that's a phenomenally high number. We have always looked at the issue of air quality. as one in the metro where we know we're close to being over the federal standards, that if we just stay under the federal standards, then that doesn't impose a cost on our businesses. But those costs are really small compared to the health care costs that the rest of us bear, and our system, our health system, bears. So I think it would be important for us to understand the relationships here, which I do not. This is not a question that I know the answer to.
Yeah, were you talking about the, when you're talking about the existing standards, you mean the ozone standards or a different air quality standard?
If you'd say that again.
You were talking about air quality standards, and you said that if we stayed below the federal standard, there's no cost on business. Were you talking about the ozone air quality standard, or was there another?
We're close on ozone to the federal standard, and we're not quite as close on fine particulate matter. If you go beyond the federal standard, in other words, if we go over the top, and we haven't, then the federal government imposes more restrictions on our, specifically on our business community, in order to bring those down. That's probably about as inefficient as you can get. We are close on two. But those costs, if I remember, in the $200-300 million range. The health costs are in the $30 billion range. I can hardly say it because I can have trouble believing it, but I am going to trust that that's true, and that's statewide. So it seems to me that if we were to bring down the health costs, then business would be fine because we're not going to go over that federal standard. But I do think that's something we need to understand because we don't know the participation of our utilities in that cost.
Representative Guinness, my understanding was that we were far below the federal standard for ozone. Did you mean the new standard or the old standard?
Well,
the proposed standard, I should say, or the existing one for ozone?
Perhaps council could help, but I believe we're close on the ozone.
Mr. Eliff, do you have the parts per million memorized for ozone in the metro area, and tell us what that compares to the old or new standard, Mr. Eliff?
I might know that, Mr. Chair, but more relevant, I was at the meeting today, the Natural Resources and Environment Committee, at which PCA presented data on air pollution, and my recollection of one chart they presented was that the federal EPA is planning to reduce the ozone standards, which are now, I believe, at 75 parts per million. They're going to reduce it probably to 65. And my understanding of that chart was that in the three previous years, we haven't met 65. And the implications of that were, as Representative Guinea has said, violations that they quoted a report that the Chamber of Commerce has done some years ago to the effect of what would be the costs if Minnesota were in violation of the ozone standards. And my recollection is that that estimate was 180 to 240 million.
Representative Guinness, anything else to add before we go to more questions?
I don't have any more questions on that. It's just something I think we need to understand, and certainly, since you are a big producer, it would be helpful to understand. And I don't know what big means in that context.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this hearing. The question that I have, I want to work my way into this, so bear with me for a second. Last week, we had a presentation that was done here where they had a chart of all of the states in the union and where they all ranked as far as being CO2 producers, and Minnesota was right in the middle of that pack. When the 111D rules came out, the targets for the Midwest, North Dakota is supposed to reduce its emissions by 11%, South Dakota 35%. Iowa 16%, Wisconsin 34%, Michigan 31%, Illinois 33%, yet Minnesota were close to 42%. I think that that is a number that that's really driving what our future policies will potentially be. I have a big issue with that, where the federal government would come out and pick us out of the middle of the pack, but yet make us almost four times more, reduce our carbon emissions four times more than North Dakota. I know that commentary had been made in this committee in the past. The LEC, which Representative Hartman works very hard at, I know that some commentary came out that that seemed to be grossly unfair, and I agree with that assessment. Given that, in order to get to this 42% targeted today in the Senate, I believe there was testimony that said in order to reach this renewable standard, the testimony this morning was given that you would need approximately 900 more additional wind turbines, 1,500 more miles of transmission lines, and 11,000 additional acres of solar panels. How are you going to cover all that with just a 2% rate increase?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so this morning what we talked about the Senate, the 1,800 megawatts, assuming a 2-megawatt turbine at each place would be 900 additional megawatt or turbine locations. The solar 1,800 megawatts, essentially at 7,000 an acre or whatever, produced the amount of acreage. The transmission study was actually a MISO study, and the amount of transmission lines was to actually get to a 50% renewable standard, and not where 40% or below, so we don't think that we would have that kind of impact on the transmission system. The costs that we model, we do a production cost, so we do every year for 40 years and figure out what is the cost impact, and we put in the cost of expected renewables in the future, wind, solar, gas, all of the assumptions. What we come out with is that we see less than a 2% rate impact for those items that we've included. Again, that MISO transmission or the integration study for the larger amount of renewables wouldn't be in there. We do include, as I commented earlier, a cost of connection to the renewables. So we actually assign $150 a kW, which is a capital cost figure, to the renewable addition, so that we expect, based upon some averages that we've seen over the last 5 or 8 years, of the cost of transmission projects. When we include all of those costs and all the dispatch costs associated with, we see that we can move towards a carbon reduction plan, you know, reinvesting in our system for less than about 2% on average on an annual basis. And that's actually putting some fairly lenient costs in there for future wind and solar. We don't assume production tax credits are going to continue. We assume that those end. We assume that the solar ITC steps down from 30 to 10. So we make those assumptions that if it's not in current law, we don't assume that we're going to get it. But we believe that we can actually keep it within that 2% on average.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think that's ambitious, and I wish you the best of luck on that endeavor. I really do. Does the solar expansion also, how does taxpayer subsidies factor into that as well, as far as the cost of I look at all of this new solar, and I look at what's subsidized right now, and if we're going to add 11,000 more acres of solar panels, you know, solar farms, not only are we looking at a ratepayer impact, as described, but at our current subsidy rates, how does this factor into things? I mean, there's the devil's always in the details, and the more you dig, the more devils you find. Sometimes you just want to quit digging. But point being is that are we going to subsidize 11,000 more acres of solar panels as well? Is that part of the I mean, I know that's probably not a question for the industry, but in your opinion, do you see that the only way we could achieve that 11,000 additional acres of solar panels is to have taxpayer subsidies involved in this? Do you see that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do have the current 10% ITC that continues included in our cost estimates. So what that says, as far as a federal subsidy would go, it would be at the 10% level that's in the current law. We don't assume that there would be additional subsidies. And again, we've priced the solar, the future solar, significantly higher than what the solar that we're receiving today, to take into account the loss of the subsidies, and also taking into account that real estate might become more valuable depending upon another competing source for it. But again, I think what we've done is we have added, I think, some buffer in our cost estimates of solar that were fairly conservative, because again, we don't know exactly what that will cost, you know, 10 years from now.
Mr. Chair, maybe I can just add, as by way of background, that if you look at this, the chart of the generation additions, the red bar, which is the large solar, you know, typically we would acquire that either by building it ourselves or by putting out, asking for bids. So there's not a subsidy in the sense that you might think of with the solar rewards program, for example. We simply take the best proposal that we get at the best price that we get and purchase it at that price. So there's no other subsidy except for the fact that we need to buy it at the price that's offered to us. The blue bar, which is the distributed generation solar, you know, for those that were on the committee in 2013, know that we have a solar rewards program, which is about $5 million a year, that subsidizes rooftop solar. We have a Made in Minnesota program, which is about $15 million a year, that subsidizes rooftop and other kinds of solar that's made here in Minnesota. We have the Community Solar Garden program, which is kind of the oddball, and we're still trying to figure out exactly what the rate impact of that is going to be on our customers. But it's potentially significant, so we need to be taking a look at that. But the bulk of what we're talking about here would be put out for bids, and same way we acquired most of our wind resources, put it out for bids and get the best price that we can.
Representative Neuberger, any follow-up?
Oh, there's always follow-up, but I'll defer to my fellow members here.
Thank you. Two questions. First of all, Mr. Evans, does the Xcel Integrated Resource Plan assume that the Made in Minnesota solar program is going to be in place for the next 10 years?
Oh, Mr. Chair, in the small distributed, we actually have a price in there that I believe would take into account that it would not be in place.
That's a good assumption. Yeah.
Are you trying to send a message?
No, I just wanted to ask a question. Mr. Hager, with regards to what is the current assumption for utility scale solar right now? So not the distributed generation side, but just utility scale solar. What's the assumption right now on the pricing of that for today?
The pricing that we see today, Mr. Chairman, for utility scale is roughly around $75 a megawatt hour in Minnesota. Obviously, it's very dependent upon the location and the solar intensity, but in Minnesota, it's $75. And just for a comparison's sake, we're using a levelized cost out in the outer years of $95 a megawatt hour.
And Mr. Hager, would that be primarily because of the reduction in the subsidy of the ITC from 30 to 20?
Yes. Okay, and some effects of inflation, obviously.
Sure. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Can you help me understand the generation addition just a little bit? Is this weighted? In other words, you were just talking about utility-grade solar. The capacity factor is, I was told by those that are going to be supplying you energy, about 20% with the current fields that they're doing. They're actually putting one in not too far from my home. It's 75 acres, and the capacity factor is, you know, at 20%, and they're going to produce 8.5 megawatts of power. And when I do the math out, just using that as an example, I get to a little bit higher number of how many acres will be out of production, because that's actually farm. But in looking at this, is this weighted? Because, you know, if you've got a capacity factor of 20 versus 40 for wind versus 95% or so for nuclear, do you take that into account when you're doing this?
Mr.
Hager.
Mr. Chair and Representative, this is actually a nameplate, so it has nothing to do with the capacity ratings. So this would be nameplate additions based upon, if you've got 100 megawatt solar, it's 100 megawatts shown on the chart. It has nothing to do with the actual capacity credit that we get. So if you look back at that first slide, the resource capacity addition slide, you could see the solar being there in the purple, even though we're adding 2,200 megawatts of nameplate, we only get around 1,000 megawatts of capacity. Mm-hmm. So that's where we would take into account the credit we get. So we get 14% credit for wind. We get roughly 50% credit for single-access tracking solar, and that's where we would take into account. The resource addition page is just simply nameplate. So in other words, it's 100 megawatt wind, it's 100 megawatts on there. 100 megawatt solar, it's 100 megawatts. Because that's how the industry would look at what opportunities there would be and what kind of capital investment would be on the nameplate rating, as opposed to the capacity addition or credit we get is something that we deal with just between us and MISO.
So that's an important point, members. I hope everyone got that, the difference between nameplate and actual generation, that different level, different energy sources, even the same energy source in different locations has a much different capacity factor. So,
yeah, I mean,
Mr. Hager.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, when you look at a solar array, you could get from a single axis, you could get 40% energy generation during a year, right? So it generates 40% of the hours. You could get a rooftop that's only 20% of the hours. And we get different credits from those different, even though there might could be both 100 megawatts, right? So when we're looking at the additions, they're just nameplate because that's identity that people can ascribe to when they see, like if we were to announce a 200 megawatt project, that's a nameplate project as opposed to an accredited value project.
Representative O'Neill, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, please. Thank you, Chair. So could you possibly provide something to us that's a little bit more reality than the nameplate? Because reality of how many megawatts you're actually going to be generating is substantially less. So this makes it look like it's equal when it's really not. I mean, the actual energy you're actually producing is substantially less than what this is. And even, I'm not sure that this is even really accurate with what you're actually going to be producing. The credit is different than what you're actually going to be producing. I mean, I've talked to your supplier of who's going to be supplying you about 100 megawatts of solar, and, you know, I was at the meetings when they were talking about it, and the max capacity factor that they had with the most current solar panels that they're going to be putting out in Wright County, like I said, they're taking 75 acres of productive farmland out of production to produce 8.5 megawatts of power 20% of the time, not 95% of the time like our nuclear plant in Monticello. So it's not apples to apples at all. You know, if you're talking about what you're really producing, you know what I'm saying? If we could have, there's a lot of freshmen and new members here that I think would appreciate looking at the reality of what you're actually going to
sure.
be producing.
And maybe the, Mr. Chair and Representative, the issue is, it's kind of what I was talking about earlier. You have the capacity planning, and then you have the energy planning. And really what you're talking about is how much energy comes off those facilities as opposed to capacity. The nameplate deals with the capacity. The accredited value is capacity. That's really what you get credit for on peak day. What you're really asking is how much energy comes off those resources. Mm-hmm. And that would be in the energy pie as opposed to the capacity pie. So when you think about when we say we're going to add 2,200 megawatts of solar total, that would be about 20% of our 10,000 megawatt system, yet it only produces less than 8% energy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the energy look that we put on these pie charts, because the energy production is a lot different. That's why we'll actually have less nuclear power from a nameplate perspective, yet it's at, you know, 28% energy. So this chart is really what you're interested in from an energy perspective, as opposed to the other one, which is a capacity or a peak day credit. That's kind of the different worlds.
Exactly. And I think it's important for the I think it's important for the committee to realize reality versus nameplate. You know, what's, for instance, I was out at a solar garden, I guess, for Wright Hennepin, and it was just a 30 kW field, but the day that I was there was cloudy, and so it only produced 10 in the middle of the day. 10 kW was all it was producing. So, you know, And that's in the middle of the day. I think it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I think it's important for us to understand that it's not apples to apples and, you know, nuclear that's producing, you know, they're, what they tell me, Monticello is between 94 and 95% mm-hmm. of the time they're producing energy, and that's 670 megawatts of power all the time. Sherco produces, last I talked to them, it was 2,400 megawatts of power. Mm-hmm. So, and that's, you know, only offset by wind. So, you know, that's quite a bit of the time, too. I mean, 85, 90% of the time they're producing. So it's just important for us to understand these aren't apples to apples exactly. I appreciate those other charts. It'd be nice to know what the megawatts were, or at least, you know, so we can kind of get to that as well.
Yeah, maybe just to help clarify this. Megawatts would be the capacity, so that's kind of the equivalent of a capacity unit, and the energy is in megawatt hours, and so that's why megawatt hours takes into account the number of megawatts times the number of hours. And so that's where you're trying to get to, I think, is what is the energy production level? So you're looking for that megawatt hour number, and that's why the energy charts show that in the megawatt hours, because it takes into account time, production, and capacity.
Mr. Hager, Mr. Evans, would it be possible just to get a chart that puts those numbers for new generation, just mm-hmm. put the megawatt hours? Would that
yeah.
be, and we, if you could just send it to the committee legislative assistant, that way the entire committee has it. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. How long was Monticello shut down for the repairs that were 100% over budget?
Mr. Evans.
Don't know the answer to that.
Representative Hortman.
Is it like 6 months, a year?
Mr. Evans.
I got nothing.
So I'll just, I want to say
the situation of Monticello was shut down for the uprate and the improvements that were required for relicensing. I don't remember how long it was shut down for, and I'm frankly not even certain it was shut down for more than the planned period. The costs were certainly greater than what we had planned for, but I'm not sure that the outage was necessarily longer, but I will find that out.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, I think the other gentleman from Excel, and I'm sorry I missed your name, I was late.
Kurt Hager, Chairman, Hager. Representative. I think there was also the secondary issue is that the megawatts associated with the uprate, we were not able to acquire or put in place as fast as we thought we would because of the NRC licensing. And we've now started to go through that ascension so that we get the megawatts associated with the expansion. But the plant itself has been running. It's just that we weren't able to run it at the higher level.
Mr. Hager, how much was the uprate? Was it 64?
72 megawatts, 68 megawatts.
Representative Hortman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The original estimate and the cost, was it like $265 million, and then it came in at 520, something like that?
Mr. Hager, Mr. Evans?
I'll have to get that for you. I don't know.
Okay.
Representative Hartman.
And then the other piece of information would be what percentage of the proposed rate increase in the last rate case. My recollection was that was about 30% of the proposed increase was Monticello related. So, and about 70% of the increase was transmission, which is partly renewables, and then other infrastructure, which I think we've talked about. Excel was doing the right thing in terms of upgrading old infrastructure, but the media certainly gave you a hard time for that. Mr. Chair, just a couple questions about the integration study. I don't know if at the beginning of the comments you talked at all about the study that was just completed on the possible integration of higher penetrations of renewable on the grid, or was that not within the scope of what this committee was looking for today?
Representative Hortman, they wanted to talk about it, and I said, no, they couldn't. No, I'm just kidding.
That wouldn't surprise me, Mr. Chair.
No, I did not.
Surprise
that, that is not true. No, they we talked a little bit about the MISO integration, but we did not talk about the
study.
Department of Commerce.
Mr. Chair, are you planning to have a hearing on that since it just came out?
I think there's a pretty good chance we're going to have it, but no guarantees.
I can't remember how much money was sunk into that, but it seems like a good idea that maybe we hear what the results were. My understanding was it was the technical people from the various utilities looking from a technical standpoint of what integration of renewables was possible.
Yep, and Representative Harbin, just for members of the committee to know, the study did two things. One is it looked at increasing, I think it was to 40%. And then the second one was to go to 50%, is that right?
I think the way that it was phrased was levels above that, but I'm not sure what the technical folks precisely analyzed. I haven't read the study, but I think it would be good for us to see a presentation. We're PowerPoint kind of people, so I think hearing the high points from the professionals would be better than all of us trying to read it.
I think there's a pretty good chance we'll do that, Representative Martin. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
Quick question. First of all, with regards to the 2% reduction, or 2% increase in pricing, as part of that, Mr. Hager, are there avoided costs that are built into that calculation? So in other words, are there costs that normally, on a baseline assumption, Xcel assumes they would have, but as a result of these efforts, you're actually able to lower?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. How we would do and how we would evaluate the impact is we would do kind of a run with the plan and a run without the plan. And so the reference case would be the case that we would be comparing the proposed plan to, and the 2% increase on average would be against that reference case.
And so, Mr. Hager, can you provide some examples of what some of those reference points would be that would be changing? For example, is there an assumption of a carbon tax or a price of carbon, or what would be, not every single variable, what are some of the variables that would be involved?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. When we talk about the 2%, there is no carbon cost, no carbon tax, nothing to do with carbon included. When we're looking at a rate impact study like this, we're trying to figure out exactly, outside of the societal cost, what customers are going to pay. Most of what would be there would have been natural gas generation that would have been displaced. To give you an idea, the assumptions are very important to that, so we use a four-source blend for our natural gas pricing.
Can you repeat that again? A what?
A four-source blend. So we actually take three developed forecasts from industry experts, Wood Mackenzie, Cambridge Energy, Energy Research Associates, and PIRA, and then we take the NYMEX and we blend them together so we're not influenced by any one entity to come up with a long-term price forecast. And again, that's what would be most likely the generation that's being then measured against in the preferred plan.
So, for example, if the fuel that you're not having to pay for, the natural gas, your wind is free, or, you know, wind fuel and solar fuel are free, and the cost of natural gas, it would be an offset that is actually, I don't want to say avoided cost because that means a different term, but...
Yeah, well, yeah. And to some degree, it really is an avoided cost. So in the one model run, let's say you had natural gas at $5, so that produced $35 energy. And on the other hand, we've got solar at $95. So the difference of costs that we're talking about would be the delta between those two.
Gotcha.
Now, Mr. Chairman, what's important is you not only have the energy, but you have the capacity costs. That way we've kind of talked about capacity and energy because they actually are both factored in.
And then before we go to Representative Clark, I just got a quick question. Why are you assuming single cycle versus combined cycle for your new natural gas generation?
Because the system is actually, Mr. Chairman, the system is actually pretty flush with energy. And so the combustion turbine is about half of the cost of a combined cycle. And therefore, we would be putting the least cost resource on to provide that peak day capacity.
Gotcha. Okay. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question has evolved as we've gone along with this discussion. I was first going to ask a question about what nameplate was because we don't have to be a new freshman not to know what those words are. Some of us who haven't served on Energy Committee for more than a decade or two, I really need introduction to a lot of these words again, so nobody should feel silly asking those questions. So I'll probably ask a couple silly questions. But
Representative Clark, just so you know, I really hope that people will ask questions like that. It's not silly at all. Do you understand the nameplate?
I do. I think I do now. The capacity versus the actual energy. I think I've got that started to understand it. I'm not sure I understand it in depth yet. But I do have a question. One of the places that my question evolved actually was just something you just said about societal costs. Can you explain to me what you mean by societal cost? What does that include?
Mr. Hager.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the societal costs, under Minnesota rules, we have to include in part of the analysis the cost of carbon, the cost of sulfur dioxide emissions, nitrogen oxide emissions. Those would be the societal costs that would be included in the resource planning evaluation. In the discussion that I was having with the chairman about the rate impacts, we don't include those costs for determination of rate impacts. We do include those costs as a part of the plan to fully inform the commission about what are the costs with and without those societal costs in the plan.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, well, my question would be, why don't you? Is it because you never have to take responsibility for them, or why do we not? Why do you not include them? I'm thinking of some of the things I know about some of the societal costs. I know. Well, let you answer that question first.
What we're trying to do in the rate impact discussion is show what the utility bills will go up, so our percentage or our costs that the customers would see. That's most easily understood by our customers because they understand where the rates will go if this plan's put into place. There's plenty of places within the plan itself that describes all of the rest of the costs, so we do the cost runs with and without those so that they can see the differences. But when we talk about rate impacts, typically the type of customers that we talk to want to understand what is their bill going to go up based upon what it is today and what is it going to go up next year. And that's why we talk in those terms.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I think I understand that you do not expect the customers to pay for societal costs when you do rates and rate. When you're determining the rate, you're just saying to the customers, don't worry about that. We might figure it out, but we're not going to charge you for it. It's going to be a taxpayer cost. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Representative.
What
we're doing is they're not in rates today, okay? So it's societal costs are not actually included in the rates that are charged because we only charge actual cost. And so it could be a societal cost, but we don't collect them through our rates. And so when we look to the future to give a comparison to what those customers will pay in the future, we're comparing them against to the rate design they have today to what they could see in the future. And since neither of them include a direct societal cost.
Maybe, Mr. Chair, just to help illustrate, the cost of emitting carbon is a societal cost that we take into consideration when we show the commission the choices that we're making. But we don't pay a cost for carbon. If tomorrow a carbon tax were to be implemented so that we were actually paying a cost of carbon, then that tax would be passed through to our customers and they would pay the cost of carbon as well. But essentially what Kurt is saying is we don't charge our customers for costs that we don't actually incur. So we would not pass those through to the customers since we don't incur those costs.
And Representative Clark, another way of saying it would be that, for example, by having a stable and reliable energy grid, there is an economic benefit that all of us get. There's positive things that Xcel Energy provides or utilities provide. They don't get to deduct that from their rates. They don't get to say, well, look, at because you have affordable, reliable energy across the state, that benefit, they don't get to put that into their rate-based calculation. Likewise, what's commonly called the externalities, those costs are not imposed on them as well. So it's not just one side of the coin, it's both sides. Representative Clark.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I remember from previous service, though, that they do have a guaranteed rate, which not too many businesses have. So
they have an allowable rate of return. There's nothing guaranteed about it.
Well, once it's determined, then it's guaranteed. I mean, they're going to always have that.
Well, they are allowed an allowable rate of return, but there's a lot of factors that can play into whether they are successful or not. So, Mr. Evans, do you want to talk about allowable versus guaranteed, or are we off topic?
Well, I will just say I've worked for the company for 14 years, and we have never earned our allowed rate of return, so it is certainly not guaranteed.
Okay, well,
Representative Clark.
I'll try to just trying to see if I make understand that. So, but I think what I do understand, and you could use the word externalities, which I had to learn what that meant a number of years ago. Someone is paying for those externalities. Someone is paying for it. For example, one of the things that really has concerned me about some of our the way some of the pollution that happens in neighborhoods like mine and other places where there are particulates that are generating learning disabilities in our children. There was a big article about that not too long ago. That's an externality. That's a cost that somebody's paying for. Our school system is paying for it. Our Representative Bagunias mentioned something about health costs. I mean, those things are being paid by someone. We're not holding you responsible for them, even if you create them. That's my understanding of the rate. Is that correct?
Mr. Evans or Mr. Hager?
Well, that's why they're called societal costs. Society is paying a price in terms of all these things that you're talking about. But until that societal cost is monetized and we are told you're going to pay for those societal costs, we wouldn't pass those costs through to our customers. We're not incurring them. So you might say, well, there's a societal cost to emitting carbon, and society is paying that price. But no one makes us pay that price. They could. They could pass a carbon tax, or they could do something else to make us incur that cost. And if they did, we would pass that cost through to our customers. But they don't, so we don't pass it through. Doesn't mean it's not a cost. It's a societal cost.
Okay.
Representative Clark.
I think I've got that. Now I have a different question. Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I can have one more question. And this is something I don't know very much about what I'm talking about yet, so maybe you can help me. I was listening to a radio a couple weeks back, and I didn't catch the whole program, but they were talking about the fact that, for example, in California, the utilities companies are becoming, they're changing what they're doing. They're not just generating, they're not going to be even in the business necessarily of generating power, but they're going to be the brokers because they feel that would be more profitable than as renewables come online. It would be more difficult for an existing type of power generator to make a profit. So do you know what I'm talking about, that there's been some change of that? And that the question was, I don't know if you heard, are familiar with this, Mr. Chairman, but there's a question now, is that something we can expect to happen all over the country, where instead of being in the business necessarily of generating power, there will be our current kind of energy companies like Xcel would become more of a broker for everything, which in some ways would make the renewable energy options more neutral and more potentially something more that you'd be interested in.
Mr. Evans, Mr. Hager?
I mean, Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, I think there's a number of structures. I mean, obviously, you go down to Texas and ERCOT, there's retail choice. You go to parts of Ohio and New Jersey, and there's retail choice, and therefore independent power producers are providing that energy. In California, independent power producers provide a lot of the energy. I think the structure of the utility business in California is very unique to California, and to the extent that that type of structural change would come to Minnesota, then we'd have to deal with, you know, is it retail choice or is it something else? But I think the California situation's been evolving. You know, they were headed down towards retail choice and backed away from it, and then they have different programs. So I think it's pretty unique to California right now. But there are certainly other models across the United States.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just make a commitment to try to understand it more and maybe come back with a more intelligent question next time.
No, it's an intelligent question. It's complicated, though. So there's no...
I should just add, you know, we do obviously own the generation that's represented by some of our power plants. Most of our wind, however, we don't own. We purchase that energy from an independent power producer. Much of our solar we will not own. We will purchase that energy from an independent power producer. And I believe, you know, the PUC is considering ordering us to sign a contract with a gas plant, an independent power producer gas plant, as the least cost resource as a part of a competitive bidding process. So there is already in Minnesota some examples of independent power producers that sell energy to Xcel Energy that is not energy we produced with our own equipment.
Sure.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure members are like done and ready to go have dinner. Now, I just have two kind of quick points or questions. One is the capacity factor for the nuclear plants. How do you calculate that when you have a shutdown for multiple months? Do you do a rolling 3-year average to come up with what you assign the capacity factor to be to a plant, whether it's nuclear or coal?
Mr. Hager?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, There's actually a number of different ways to look at capacity factors. There's an availability factor. There's a capacity factor. There's an unplanned outage. There's a planned outage rate. So there's a whole bunch of different aspects to look at what you're trying to look, you know, overall. If you're trying to look at, you know, just a typical, you would take 8760 times the nameplate rating of the plant, you know, the total energy divided by that.
Explain what 8760 is.
Okay.
Number of hours in a year.
So take number of hours in a year times the nameplate rating of the plant to get the total possible, and then you would look at the total production, and that would give you a capacity factor. But doing that, we measure all sorts of things. So you exclude planned outages out of that. So there's a whole bunch of different ways. There's actually what's called GADS, which I generation attribute data system or something like that, that actually collects all of this data from every plant, I think, in the United States and reports it to EIA, and they publish the GADS data on every plant. And, you know, and so there, depending upon, again, what you're trying to look at, is it runtime outside of planned outages, or is it overall runtime? There's a whole bunch of different definitions.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, it just seems like if capacity factors, you know, how often can you count on it? And it seems like that would be the number of hours that it's running. So I don't know. I don't understand the reason you would exclude planned outages or unplanned outages from the equation, because that's part of the reality of the energy source. Just as you have your hot day in the summer when the wind isn't blowing, you have your hot day in the summer when your nuke plant isn't operating because it's a planned outage or an unplanned outage. So it seems like to do apples to apples, you just would look at the hours that they produce energy.
Representative Rager. Again, every plant has to go through some sort of maintenance cycle, and obviously some maintenance is longer than others depending upon what kind of plant it is, and so that kind of measurement takes it into account. When you said, is it available on a peak day, that's a little bit different because that's an availability on a peak day. And so when we look at that, that's more the capacity, not the energy side. So you're moving away from this capacity factor for a whole year, and now you're moving to what is it available for capacity accreditation to MISO. And MISO actually takes into account a three-year average of the availability of the plant on the peak day, and that's what they give us credit for. And so when MISO sees that it's not available on a peak day, then they don't give us credit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman.
So, well, it sounds like everybody has different capacity factor numbers. MISO would have a different capacity factor for Monticello than you would.
Well, again, we would probably have the same for the definition that we're talking about. So, again, there's just multiple definitions in the industry based upon, are you looking at a annual average energy production versus an availability on peak day number.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure you probably know what got me going here is the idea that nuclear is 95% capacity factor and solar is like 20%, when if we exclude planned outages and unplanned outages, that might be true, but I think you have to include planned and unplanned outages if you're a consumer and you're paying for it.
Mr. Hager, if we include planned and unplanned outages, what would be the approximate capacity factor for nuclear power?
Well, again, on an annual average basis, depending upon if you had an outage in a year, you would, on a good year that you didn't have an outage, you'd probably be up at 95%. If you had an outage, it would probably be something less, maybe 80%. But again, that's looking at annual usage of a year, not what availability. A nuclear facility would get pretty much close to 100% nameplate, unless there was an issue as far as availability, but typically we'd get 100% of our nameplate. So accredited capacity from MISO for, let's say, Monticello would be 670 megawatts. For a solar array, we would probably only get about 50% of that accredited capacity credit to us from MISO. Because, again, they take into account that sunshine's not going to be there all the time, especially at that time of the day. And so when they come up with their capacity accreditation values, they take that into account that it's going to be less than nuclear.
Okay. Representative Hartman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Evans, when Representative Clark was asking about externalities, the pollutant that you grabbed was CO2, I mean, I think a more interesting one, a more concrete one, I guess, maybe, would be particulate matter. And the point I think Representative Clark was making is there is a relationship between particulate matter and asthma expenses and certain health care expenses, and Excel doesn't have to pay those expenses. Some proportion of them is paid by all of us in our health insurance premiums or our taxes in our public paid health programs, and we don't attribute that to the company. So, you know, I mean, the question that I asked my neighbor here is the next Aaron Brockovich case the particulate matter case versus a utility, you know, a coal-fired power plant? Because somebody pays for it. Mm-hmm. And the question right now is it the right entity that's paying the cost?
Representative Neuberger.
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been a really good evening here. I wanted to touch on the societal costs here, but I also think that we need to take into consideration the societal benefits. I live 1 mile downwind from the Sherco power plant, which all of you know is the largest power plant in the Midwest. I have pine trees and apple trees, and I grow things, and my kids were born with two eyeballs and two arms and two legs, and they're looking good. I have the current epidemiology report from the Minnesota Department of Health on asthma specifically, and there has been no changes in asthma. It's according to their report, it's the conclusions, I could pull it up for you here. I read it this morning, but the conclusions are that it has been no significant change in asthma figures in Minnesota here. Also with your particulate matter, I'm glad you guys brought this up, because the MPCA has they put out their air quality standards right now, today. The air quality index for Minnesota, for most of it, is good. 0 to 50 for particulate matter. Right around the metro, we've got about 50, and that's called moderate, and the only people that are really in trouble, it says air quality is acceptable. However, individuals who are very, very sensitive to air pollution may experience adverse health effects. So my hat's off to the energy producers for the good job that you are doing. When we talk about societal effects, well, let me tell you a story here. One of the societal impacts is how many jobs that these power plants provide. The Sherco power plant, as the Excel people know, employs about 350 full-time workers. These are feed-your-family jobs. During the peak of their maintenance cycle, union jobs. At the peak of the maintenance cycle, it's up to 800 jobs. The standard economic formula for every production job is about 5 service-related jobs. So to Sherco alone, that area, we're looking at roughly 4,000 to 5,000 jobs. So I want to say thank you for being an economic engine for central Minnesota. Also, there's a high-pressure steam line that runs from Sherco 1 and 2 to Liberty Paper, which is about a quarter mile away. That high-pressure steam is used for production of paper. If we lose Sherco 1 and 2, we also lose Liberty Carton, which is another 150 feed-your-family jobs. Then times that by 5 for your standard economic value for service-related jobs. So the societal benefits, I just want to say thank you for what you've done for this state and for the mouths that you've fed and for the mortgages that you've paid and for the kids that you've put through school.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Well, I have two questions that are like this. So I'm looking at this chart. Mm-hmm. This is the capacity need, and I'm assuming that in here you reduced this by a certain amount of efficiency, because we do efficiency and we reduce our need. And I'm just trying to figure out, since that number isn't on here, what did you reduce the need by? What were you assuming for efficiency when you put out this chart?
Mr. Hager?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we use the state standard that we meet for energy efficiency of 1.5% of energy.
5%?
1.5%.
That's what I...
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, if you look at this at the chart, there's a gray bar that's labeled load management.
Right.
That includes.
Well, that's
no. That's
demand response.
Okay.
That's not
different.
Energy efficiency.
Mr. Hager.
And so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Wagenius.
So
it's built in.
Mr. Hager.
So we net. Sorry.
That's all right.
Okay. So that's a pretty low efficiency amount. And so my question is, what if you doubled that efficiency amount? I mean, it just, you put in that as an assumption, and it does seem to me there could be a range here that would change this whole chart. And I'm, and Mr. Chairman, you will hear me talking about efficiency. I live in an old house and in an old neighborhood. But all of our houses were impacted by the noise from the airport. So all the houses have, virtually most of the houses in my neighborhood have been insulated for noise, which means they're insulated for energy efficiency. And so else, it's such an irony. I mean, we bear the burden of the noise. But our houses are no longer obsolete for energy efficiency, where much of the rest of the city of Minneapolis and Richfield are obsolete. So it does seem to me that this energy efficiency that is assumed in here is very low. So had you even considered a higher number for this?
Mr. Hager.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, actually the energy efficiency is a very thorough and well-vetted process within the commission today. And actually the 1.5% I think is fairly known as a leader around the United States. Our energy efficiency program is actually one of the stronger programs, I think, in the United States. So when we look at that, they certainly do sensitivities when they go through their energy efficient dockets, and I know that they've had debates of whether 1.3 or 1.5%, but it's been in that kind of range of differences, not maybe 5%, because that would be suggesting tripling it. And so I think there's a well-vetted process for that, and certainly they look at the economics of what makes sense for energy efficiency within those dockets, and we take the output of that docket and use it as the input to this docket.
And Representative Guinness, just to be clear, with regards to the 1.5%, those are the energy efficiencies that Xcel gets credit for because of a rebate program and they help pay for it. If you and I go out and buy LED light bulbs on our own and replace our incandescent light bulbs, we're being more efficient, we're using less electricity, but that is not built into Xcel. Does not get credit for technological advances that we advance on our own, or if we put a new freezer in. In fact, now that I think about it, Dakota, you guys don't get any credit from me because I'm in the Dakota Electric Service Territory, so that's beside the point. But Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My guess is that many of us represent neighborhoods where the housing stock is obsolete for energy. I mean, there may be some of us that are in neighborhoods where all the housing stock was built after 1990 or something like that. But it does seem to me that we, maybe Xcel, I get what you're saying, but we need to look at that. And I'll just give you just one tiny little example. When we bought our house, we did the most energy efficient thing we could, and we put 13R in our attic because that was the recommended level of insulation in this attic. Now the recommendation is 49R. And I would bet, I mean, we need to understand how much of our housing stock is at 49 versus whatever. I mean, that's something we all need to grasp before we understand what how much energy we actually need.
Do most homes in Minneapolis have electric heat?
Pardon?
Do most homes in Minneapolis have electric heat, or is it natural gas?
Well, we would have natural gas. We wouldn't have electric heat, but it is, you'd be surprised how many people who would use electricity as a supplement. unfortunately. But it's the big picture here.
Sure. So outside of the electricity presentation.
It's outside the electricity because I am saying I get the credit of the 1.5% for them. But when you said what's what we do, but as we measure the what we need in the big picture, we are measuring it against a lot of houses and industry that's anything but efficient. And how do we grapple with that as the committee? I don't know the answer to that. I bring up the question. You get to figure it out.
Sure.
Could I ask him one more question?
You may.
So when you were talking about the societal costs, and I get it, what you're talking about, the societal costs, but you did say that when you talk to PUC, you do make some estimates for the costs of carbon and sulfur and a few other things. Did I get that correctly?
That is correct.
Mr. Hager, what was the third one? There was CO2.
Oxides sulfur. Of nitrogen, sulfur dioxide, and carbon.
What sort of form of nitrogen?
Oxides. NOx, NOx.
It does seem to me that with the health costs running at $30 billion a year, and then we don't know your portion of it, but that should be one of those in the list we talked to PUC about. And maybe that's another thing that is on your plate, Mr. Chair, to deal with.
I think it'd be an interesting conversation to try to calculate what percentage of the $30 billion in health costs come from particulate matter. It'd even be more interesting to find out how much of that particulate matter actually could be attributed to the Sherco power plants in northwestern, up in Sherburne County. But I think in terms of measuring the externalities, again, if Excel is going to get dinged for the costs, the social costs, then we're going to have to start talking about giving them the social benefits. And even though they don't get to reflect that in their rate base, the reality is they provide a societal benefit beyond what Representative Neuberger said. Just the fact that we can count on our electricity, I mean, there's a societal benefit there. There's a price to that.
No,
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I think you're missing my point. I'm not saying that we should be doing some pulling money in for paying for those costs. It is when PUC is looking at the mix of stuff that they are using that the reality is that some of the stuff is producing more societal costs than others. So why aren't we giving the full information to PUC as they're wrestling with this? I'm not going beyond that.
Gotcha. Thank you. Mr. Hager, with regards to that, when wind and solar, what energy source does it replace when we introduce it onto the grid?
Mr. Chairman, it really depends what time or when the resource is acquired. So for solar, you're primarily displacing natural gas. For wind, currently in our system, it probably is 50% coal, 50% natural gas that's being displaced. In the future, as the system grows and changes, we would expect it to be more natural gas displaced in the future also.
And does natural gas have particulate matter?
I'm not an expert in combustion of natural gas. I believe there is some level of small particulates, but it's not the same level of what happens at a coal plant due to dust and so forth. So,
Mr. Hager, how about sulfur dioxide?
Sulfur dioxide out of natural gas is very small. In fact, most of the sulfur that's introduced is the mercaptans that we introduce for it to smell.
Then how about nitrogen oxide? Natural gas emit that?
There is oxides of nitrogen that comes from natural gas also, and I believe it's about 50% level of coal plant right in there.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really want to debate Representative Neuberger on the jobs and fossil fuels versus the jobs in renewable energy, but I think maybe there's a different time and a different place. but I think just a quick counterpoint, there's a 100-megawatt project, the Aurora project that was cost competitive and actually beat natural gas, according to Eric Lipman, the administrative law judge, not known as a bastion of liberalism, I don't think. But I think members of the committee would prefer that we have this debate at a different time. So, Mr. Chair, maybe I should just ask you, if I introduce a bill to increase the amount of renewable energy in the state of Minnesota, would you be willing to hear my bill and maybe let Representative Neuberger and I talk about jobs, since this committee is called Job Growth and Energy Affordability, and that bill would really talk about both issues all at the same time.
Representative Hartman, as you know, no chair negotiates what bills they're going to hear in their hearing or during a public hearing. But that being said, I do think that there's actually, to a certain degree, you are both right. And the point is that solar nationwide, I believe now that solar energy and renewable energies actually have more jobs associated with them than coal or natural gas power plants. However, those coal and natural gas power plants produce way, way, way more power than do those renewable energies. So if you look at it from a pure jobs, the number of jobs, there are more jobs associated with renewables. However, the price per megawatt is substantially higher. So I think you guys can fight about that later, but that's what the reality is. So with that, we don't have any other questions. Mr. Evans, Mr. Hager, I really want to thank you for taking the time. We found out you were going to be in town. We thought this was a great opportunity. And the purpose of this committee was that some members get a little bit more educated and understand the trade-offs with all energy policy as well as your resource plan. And I think we were successful in that. So thank you very much for being here. With that, members, we're adjourned.